Warning: the following podcast, which contains strong language and mature content, is unsuitable for children or for the faint of heart. The subject matter discussed will be frightening and graphic in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
When you want to hear about the paranormal, you get the Spooked Girls. True crime that makes you hypothermal with the three Spooked Girls. Stabby snippets will give you dreams. Tara and Jessica will make you. Along with the Spooked Girls. Bring on the slaughter. We on that haunted ground. Spooked Girls. The three Spooked Girls.
Hey, Spooksters, and welcome back to another episode here on Three Spooked Girls. My name is Tara, and as always, I'm here with my girlfriend, Jessica.
Hello.
Hello. I don't know what's wrong with my voice today. I feel like I'm losing my voice. So sorry. I know you guys just dealt with it with Quiet on the Set because I was dying, but I guess I'm just dying some more. But that's fine. Today's going to start our multi-parter on the tragic life of Judy Garland. We kind of mentioned during Quiet on the Set, we wanted to do some dark Hollywood. So we have this deep dive for you guys. And we have a couple other ones planned. So that'll be a journey. And as you can see, if you're watching on YouTube, we went with the theme. We both have Wizard of Oz backgrounds. That movie's fucking traumatic. Oh my God.
Is traumatic.
I started reading. Oh my God. We'll get into it later. I'm not gonna get into myself. But if you would like to hang out with us on social media, we're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Threads. I'm on TikTok as Spooky Sleuth. Everything's in the show notes. You can check that out. Our Facebook group is amazing. And if you want to hang out with us there, that's Three Spooked Girls Official. All kinds of stuff goes on over there. Announcements, book club, gift exchanges, anything you can think of that we talk about on here, that's where that lives. So that's kind of like our home base.
We actually just did something in the Facebook group. Like, so today this would go live on April 29th. And on April 29th, we're closing our like select the merch. So I made some merch ideas, put six of them in there, and you, the Spooksters, voted. And I don't know what it is right now because in real life, it's not Monday yet. Not for us, but we will see. The top three are going to be made into merch. So it'll be limited run, for limited time, I should say.
It's going to be great. I'm so excited. I love all of them. But yeah, so if you would like to participate in things like that, you got to go over there. And if you would like to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/threespookedgirls. For as little as a dollar, you get one bonus episode a month. Five and up get ad-free episodes, typically the day before, and any kind of fun video content that's not on our YouTube, we do for you guys over there, starting at our $5 tier. I don't got nothing else. So we're going to get into this because this turned into almost another OJ, I swear. not that many parts, but like could have been.
Mm-hmm.
So my part was supposed to only be one episode, but it is now going to be two. So you guys will get, obviously we're listening to part one right now, but then part two will come out next Monday, and just strap the fuck in. And then Jess has part three, and then oh my God, we'll see. And then we're moving on to something else.
Right.
Something else for a little bit. So there's no listeners this month, obviously. So I'm going to go ahead and just get into this. To get to know Judy's story, I wanted to talk about her parents, Frank and Ethel. So we'll start with Frank. He was born on March 20th, 1886 in Tennessee to Clementine W. Boz and William, I can't pronounce the middle name, Gum. They were said to be brick masons or farm laborers type of thing, but they actually ended up doing extremely well for themselves and became super connected with other like rich and powerful people. Fun fact, Frank was actually named after a very prominent lawyer that was in their town. His name was Frank Avent. Frank was the third of five children. Families back in the day, like I feel like five's a small family.
True.
To be honest with you. My great grandma, they had like nine kids, and like her mom had nine.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. The farther you go back in like your tree, I would be like, holy shit. Like, I'm pretty sure, like, on my paternal side, my grandmother is like one of 16.
That's That's crazy.
Yeah. I was like, holy shit. Oh, and that's like God. On one side. And then on the other side, there's like more. Her parents divorced.
All the kids. A classroom.
The whole classroom.
A classroom. So Frank was described as a happy and outgoing child who was always singing. He later claimed that he once ran away to join a minstrel show. Yeah, I didn't say menstrual. I said minstrel, but they're racist AF.
Yeah.
This was bad.
I knew what you said, though.
Yeah, no, there's no basically or anything. It truly is. If you don't know what that is, because like, I'll be honest, I didn't fucking know. I had to Google it. The performers were white and they would put on blackface and perform these horrific sketches or songs and things like that, that were literally horrible stereotypes of African-Americans. Like, oh my God, so fucking, ugh, can't. But he was brought back by his brothers, and him and one of his, I don't know how many brothers he had, but one of them, they would sing on local trains, and that's how they made some money. They would pass around a hat for tips and whatnot, and, you know, they'd get a little cash. Now, I mentioned they were a connected family, so Frank's godfather, his name was George Darrow. He was a very prominent person in their town, and he was very, very wealthy. He was, it's just so funny how, like, people in the 1800s and stuff get described because they were, like, wealthy. I can't say the church name.
Episcopal.
That. I can't fucking pronounce stuff.
I got you.
They lived in the Oakland Mansion. Fun fact, this was the house which the Confederates officially surrendered.
Oh.
So.
Super fun.
Mm-hmm. Right? I'm like, okay, why do you want to live there? But moving on, George was a huge part in helping Frank break into performing and things like that. So he got him solos with their church, which was St. Paul's Church. He was the treasurer there, and his parents were communicants. Sadly, his mother would die in 1895, and their dad, William, basically, and this was pretty common, I feel. He started to rely on his oldest daughter, who was 15, to take care of the rest of the kids. But it was said Mary wasn't mature enough to do this. So it all happened when he was 9. But a few years later, so 4 years later, when he was 13, he went to live with George and his wife.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of people did that at that time, and you would go to live with people who could help.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that they were like, though that they were kind of a little better off than a lot of people, it probably was like one less mouth to feed.
Right, exactly. And they treated him great. So George went to the grammar school at, oh my God, sorry guys, Sewanee? I don't know how to say it. But it was like 50 miles away, and it was like a really good school. He went to the school on a chorus scholarship, so like for singing and stuff, and he did great. They loved him. Like, the principal sent George and his wife a really nice letter on how good he was doing and everything. So George went there to go like be like, yeah, like supportive and stuff. So it's like nothing really like bad's happening, you know what I mean? And because George was so well known, people referred to Frank as his protege.
Which, that makes sense.
Yeah. And along with the choir stuff, he was also part of the campus newspaper, and he was in like the school plays and stuff, and everyone just thought he was extremely talented. So after high school, he went to the college there, which is now known as University of the South, and he continued singing. He was in musical productions. He was in like plays. It says like dramatic entertainments, but plays, things like that, you know.
Dramatic entertainment.
I'm like, okay.
I don't know why. That just like, that's a funny way to say something.
Right. He was done with college in 1907. He kind of pulled a like a Van Wilder, because he's quoted saying that this was the 6 happiest, most beautiful years of my life.
Oh, Van Wilder. Which, super excited when I found out that actually is based on a real life story.
I know. Wild, huh?
And that I also love, is it Bert? Why can't I think of his name? Bert.
Mm-hmm.
That I love him so much. So I was like, oh my God, yay.
I love that. I haven't watched that in so long. Oh my God. Now, during his last year of school, his dad ended up dying. So the kids were like older, because like I said, he was the 3rd out of 5. So, you know, they're adults. And so everyone kind of just like dispersed to do their own thing, right? But Frank, being only 21, he was like, I don't know what the the fuck I'm going to do. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life, right? So he went and lived with one of his brothers and sisters in Tullahoma, and he got a job there, and he was a bookkeeper and then an office manager for Walter D. Fox. And he also was interested in the orphanage that Walter had founded. So he kind of like helped with that. He dabbled in like journalism, and he, of course, still was singing and performing. And at this point, he was at the Vaudeville House, the Citizens Theater. Then in 1912, he started working at the People's Amusement Company in Portland, Oregon. So he moved, and he had used his experience he had in Tullahoma to get the job for that. And he was basically managing the theater at that point, and he also let them know about all his performing experience. So he did both. And he ended up staying there for about 2 years. He did move to Superior, Wisconsin, because Frank, as you will come to learn, has a liking to sleeping with young men, sometimes teenagers.
Oh, mm-hmm. I don't like you, Frank.
Yeah. Well, there's only like, and it's not even excusing him. I don't know for sure if the Portland ones had any minors, but one I'll talk about later did. And that's why they fucking do-do-do. So he moved to Superior, Wisconsin. He relocated because people were fighting this shit out. And it's 1913. So obviously you couldn't be openly gay. You couldn't.
And the problem, I want to clarify, the problem I had with it is the minor part. Like, I don't care if you're gay. Like, I just want to.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I want to, before people come for me later, be like, it's more about, you know, the minor issue.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, yeah. I'm literally gay. Just saying, guys. It's fine.
It's true. My best friend.
It's fine.
Exhibit A.
Oh, but also fun fact, though, about Portland real quick before we move on to Superior. He was engaged to a woman named Catherine McGraw. I don't know what their situation was with him stepping out. He would perform like across the U.S. too and stuff. And basically, she just got tired of waiting for him and they broke up. And she actually started dating another guy in the vaudeville circuit named Joe E. Brown, and he later became very successful in Hollywood.
By the way, I like that you said, I'm literally gay, and there's literally a rainbow coming out of your head.
Yeah. For those that can't see, my background's the poppy field, Emerald City, and then a rainbow.
Oh, God. Okay.
So we're in Superior now, right? This area was like, I don't know, pretty busy. They had a lot of movie theaters. A bunch of them were owned by this guy named Ray Hadfield. And this is who hired Frank as a singer that September when he relocated. He ended up partnering at the Hadfield's Savoy Theater with Maude Ayres. And they were accompanied by a woman who played the piano for them, and her name is Ethel Milne. And they are said to have, quote, fell into an immediate accord. I'm like, okay.
That doesn't say I loved you. That means we were very good friends.
So here's the thing. Ethel was like super all about Frank, and he still would go and like travel and do shows and stuff. She'd fucking wait for him. She fucking waited for him. Her goal was to get married to Frank.
Got it.
And we're going to talk about Ethel. I don't have quite as much information as I do with Frank, but that's okay because fuck Ethel. So Ethel was born on September 17th, 1893. Her parents were Eva Fitzpatrick and John Milne. She was one of seven children, and she grew up in Duluth. Then the family moved to Superior. She was working at this place called 5 and 10, selling sheet music, and was playing, like, she would play little gigs in the evenings. And that's where Hadfield had seen her, and he invited her, and then, you know, then she's doing these shows with Frank and Maude. No surprise, because of his sexuality, Ethel and Frank's relationship was more of a business partnership, and that was kind of known to people, versus romantic. But it worked for them, so nobody really thought anything of it, right? Because you have to think, these people, well, like, some obviously will know, but like, majority of people did not know his sexuality at this point.
Got it.
There is a sad thought that Frank decided to marry her because he thought that marriage could, quote, cure him.
I don't think that was an uncommon thought back then.
No, I don't think so either. That was actually probably a pretty common thought, I feel.
It is very sad because it's like you're not living your authentic self.
Yeah. He had decided he did not want to be one of those people that, like, if the marriage didn't work, he was going to, like, come out type of thing. Like, he wasn't going to be like, like, oh, marriage led me to my sexuality, whatever. Basically, he thought if he married her too, it would put the temptation of wanting to sleep with men like in a corner somewhere or something.
It's like, you can't fault him for trying to get to that intuitively. Like, okay, well, maybe if I just distract myself.
Yeah. At least at first, it was very much like a, obviously he had love for her, but it was just, you know, different. So the couple had made friends with a Mr. and Mrs. C.E. Akins. They had been a middle-aged couple who was visiting the area. They were like on vacation. They lived in Grand Rapids, which is kind of like a neighboring area. Essentially, they got offered a job opportunity in Grand Rapids. So that was going to be like a huge step for them. And Frank and Ethel got married on January 22nd, 1914 in Superior. They had a ceremony, all of that. They had dinner, like a whole banquet type of situation, and they set up a stage, and then the couple and then the bridal party were all up on the stage when, you know, for the reception, like whole thing, you know.
Oh, I thought you were about to tell me that they like did an actual performance. And I was like, I'm here for that.
Oh, no.
I'm like, I really I'm gonna say this, I really get disappointed when I know people have like actually like good musical talent or something like that, and then their wedding happens and you're like, you didn't even do one number? Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Not even this one?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like, Ethel was not talented in, like, singing.
Right. She could play the piano.
Yeah.
I also, like, am imagining that their entire bridal party is part of this, like, scene of, of like, vaudevillians. So it's like, oh my God, you have all this talent. And then...
Well, that's the thing. Like, most people thought she was just not super talented. Like, maybe she was just average. I don't know. But Ethel turns into a horrible person, spoilers, so I don't really care. But so he didn't have to be at the new place. The new place was the new Grand Theater that had opened in January of 1914. And they didn't have to be there until March. Now, like I said, they got married, all of that stuff. They pushed it to March because his contract with Hadfield wasn't complete until the end of February, basically. But I think it was Frank. Pretty much Ethel was like a yes man to him at first. So they came up with this idea that they were just going to be like, nah, fuck that theater. Let's just go travel and get famous type of thing. Well, they didn't get very fucking far. Like, I want to say it was like day two or something. Ethel got super fucking sick. So they had to come back. And then they were just like, well, guess that's a sign. So then they just fucking went to Grand Rapids instead. They were supposed to go to like Florida. I'm like, Florida? Okay. Why not California? Like, one, it's probably closer. And two, like, hello. But... I was like, that's random. I don't know. But yeah, basically that didn't happen. They went to Grand Rapids and that's where they ran the Grand Theater. So the Grand Theater was, quote, to show 4,000 feet of fine film. So the proprietors were Barlow and Bentz. They had it constructed with a stage. So this way the vaudeville companies, you know, they could come perform here at a venue. It seated 450 people and stood four square on the main street in town. Now, like I said, they got hired to run things. So when they got there, Frank acted as a performer and also the manager. And Ethel did what made most sense and took charge of all musical arrangements because obviously she plays piano, like, you know, obviously knows how to read music, probably knows how to write music, that kind of thing. And Bentz, which his name is Fred, he operated the projector and basically he let Frank take care of all the bookings for, you know, films and the acts because he was like, probably like, that ain't my thing. I don't want to do that.
And Frank had like the accountant and stuff background. So it probably made more sense too, because he probably understood how to balance everything.
Right. Exactly. So they got back into church and at the church, Ethel played the organ and Frank became the like conductor of the choir. So they were settling in just fine. And when they first moved there, they actually ended up living with the Akins, the ones that they had met for a time because they had like a pretty big house and, you know, they owned a fucking theater. So obviously they were pretty well off. They were very in the social scene and all of that. So that gave an end to Ethel and Frank. Ethel started running her own bridge parties and Frank joined the local fire brigade. So they were living their lives. They were settling in just fine. Also, it's said slash thought they had to leave Superior because of the same shit that happened in Portland.
Oh.
But after that, they moved from the Aikens' house and they rented their own. And then they moved again. They moved a few times. So they moved again into, they're just called hospital apartments. And that had a garden, which was like something they were super excited about. In September of 1915, they had their first child, Mary Jane. And, you know, they're living in Grand Rapids and what have you. And then Frank got a new, like an additional gig type of thing. So a couple years later, in March of 1917, the Itasca County Independent, the newspaper, hired him to report on all of the social happenings and activities there in Grand Rapids.
Ooh.
And this was a busy year for them. Their second daughter, Dorothy Virginia, who's, if you've read or consumed anything about Judy Garland in her life, she's referenced as Virginia. They had these two little girls and they were, you know, they were always like super little outgoing things. They liked to participate, however little toddlers can participate in like their musical activities that their parents are doing, like all of that. Everything was good. About the time that Virginia was born, Frank made a friend or an acquaintance that became a friend of someone who's really important and the reason Judy existed. That person's Mark Rabwin. His original name was Marcus Rabinowitz, but he changed his name. He was a Nepo baby. So his dad, who was also named Frank, owned a cinema, and Mark was only 16 at the time, but he helped his dad run it. And his dad also held the local franchise for the W.W. Hodkinson Company, which was an agency for film distribution. So it's like the two things went hand in hand. That totally makes sense. Mark and Frank first met on a business trip he had made to Grand Rapids in order to like persuade the theater, the new Grand, you know, the theater Frank was managing, to play some of their films and stuff. And Mark apparently had been warned by other salesmen that Frank was nuts, quote, quote, constantly pacing the floor when they tried to talk to him and staring at them belligerently with his bulging eyes. Okay, maybe he's just trying to make you uncomfortable so you leave because he doesn't want to buy your shit.
He figured it out a long time ago, guys. It's his strategy. Leave him alone.
Yeah. Now, Mark, he was planning on going into medicine. So, you know, he's just like, I'm just doing this to help my dad. What the fuck ever. I'll go talk to them. But when he was around him, he already had been dabbling in medical stuff. He was like, hey, I think something's up with your thyroid. And so Frank got checked, got treated. Like, he was right. So I'm like, damn, that guy helped you out. But because like of that, they did build this working relationship. And Frank decided to play some of the movies that they had. So, you know, win-win. Like I said, the family moved a lot. So in 1819, they moved. And then also in 1919, the move in March of 1919 was to their home that they purchased. And this was located on Hoffman Avenue and was Judy Garland's first home, which she remembers in like interviews. And she says was a quote, a little white wooden house in a big garden. Now, this house was moved from that location in 1938 to, I'm not going to say the address, but in 1919, it stood on a corner site in the center of town. So they only had like a 5-minute walk to the theater. And they were 3 blocks from the school. And right across the street was the railway station. It was like prime spot, I would say.
Sounds like it. Sounds like it'd be loud, but it also sounds like it's a really good like destination house, if that makes sense. Like you're like, I can go anywhere from here.
Right.
It's the perfect commuter spot.
Right. Per the description, if you see it today, it is a nondescript in an agreeable New England frame style. And obviously there's been updates. There's an open porch with the balcony above, which the Gums did have, but has been since incorporated into the parlor. They added windows and the house was just like they had high ceilings. There was now 3 bedrooms, but none of them obviously super, super big because rooms in old houses like that never were big to begin with. So you ain't got much square footage to work with. And a small bathroom, which then they made into another bedroom. But basically, it was just big enough for a family of four, plus they're almost like a nanny. So basically, this girl named Inga Morin, her family was from Sweden, and they had lived on a farm that was 20 miles away. And obviously, back then, I don't know if they met them at church or like how they actually like started helping this girl. But basically, because obviously, like now 20 miles is nothing, but like back then, like obviously that's not a fucking commute. She stayed with them, and basically to pay for her room and board and all that, she would take care of the house, and I'm assuming obviously the kids, when Frank and Ethel went to the theater at night.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, works out. So with that, we are gonna take a quick ad break. We have some mid-rolls for you guys, and we will be right back. All right, so getting back to the Gum family. Like we've discussed, they've settled in pretty good. They had a normal social life, like everything was good. But, Frank's evenings began to be male-oriented.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. And during the time when he started working at the Independent, him and Bence opened a new theater and the new Grand closed. They ended up using the same name and stuff, but they made it so instead of it being, you know, over 400 people to be seated, they scaled back to 385 because that was just the number that was just more manageable for them, type of thing. Now, Mark's gonna come back up. He did go on to study medicine, like he planned. He went to the University of Minnesota in St. Paul, but he continued his friendship with the Gums. So in winter of 1921, he was woken up in the middle of the night by Frank, highly agitated. Frank was highly agitated and was pacing up and down and said he needed professional advice because Ethel was 2 months pregnant and she wanted an abortion.
Oh, shit.
And Frank wanted his friend to perform it because obviously this was illegal. And during this time period, they fucking did like backwoods, scary, like basement abortions. Well, Mark came to believe that Ethel's unwillingness to have another kid was that she thought that Frank was unfit to be a father because of his sexuality.
Oh.
Now, this wasn't really brought up, but what Mark did instead was he talked with them and he really just suggested not doing this because of how dangerous it was. And he spun it to Frank that he would never regret having his third child, which is true.
I mean, talk about a prophecy.
Because that was Judy. Judy was born on June 10th, 1922. Her birth name was from both of her parents. Her birth name was Frances Ethel Gum. Now, around this time, and as more time has went on, Frank's getting closer to 40 at this point. And basically, he has come to a place where he's self-accepting and he doesn't feel guilt about his extracurriculars. He just doesn't. He succeeded in getting these interactions because of his influence and how well liked he was and how popular he was. The old story of using his power to get what he wants type of thing.
Right. I was like, this seems like a very, very easy tale as old as time moment.
Yes. Now, as we will find out, Ethel becomes the worst stage mom of all fucking time. I swear to God. Judy's grandma actually contributed to this at the start. She was the one that convinced Ethel and got Judy kind of like as excited as you can get to perform. Because Judy was only 2 and a half when she performed for the first time. She sang Jingle Bells. People were like, dang. I know she's a little kid, but like she got a good voice for a little like toddler. Okay. She would be known as Baby Gum back then. Ethel, she put all her girls into this. So the three of them became known as the Gum Sisters. And in an interview I watched when she was asked about this, she said, as I look back on it, the first 4 years of my life were the happiest I ever had, which is really sad. This whole story is just so sad.
I know, it's so heartbreaking.
But things weren't very peachy for very long. Because initially, the community overlooked Frank's activities. After Mark left, there was like this situation with these high school boys and word got around. So basically, people stopped coming to the theater. So he got behind on rent. So they had to fucking leave. They had to do what he always did. Go move somewhere else where nobody knew him. At this point, they moved to California in 1926. They kind of bounced around a little bit looking at other places, but they ended up buying their home and living in Lancaster. Judy has said plenty of times that this was the moment that changed everything for them. She says, "From the day we arrived in Lancaster and all the wonderful carefree fun and joy, my family began to vanish. Suddenly, Mother decided we had to be stars. She started to drag us to any place someone important might see us. Because Frank was cheating on her so much, basically her coping mechanism to that was to just put all of her energy into her kids and into their careers. I also think she was living through her children because, yes, yeah, she could play piano and, you know, that stuff. But as far as like acting and stuff like that, and I'm assuming singing, she was described as having no talent there. So obviously that was not going to be an option for her, especially being a mom to three kids during this time.
Right.
Judy has such an impressive career. She had her career for over 40 years. It's seriously countless stuff as far as performances because she was everywhere. She was on the stage, on the screen, on television. Over her time during acting, she was in 34 feature films. That's a lot.
That is a lot.
Especially because, like, as you'll see, a lot of these are like back to back.
And at the time, like, now you can shoot like a movie in 6 months and like a full ass movie in 6 months. But like, movies used to take years to make.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And like, if you're moving fast, you could maybe get it done in a year. Maybe.
And that's like a short movie.
Yes. And, you know, while in Lancaster, they purchased and opened another theater. And while there, on top of, you know, trying to go be seen by important people that would make her kids stars, she also had them in acting classes, in dancing classes, all kinds of things. And basically, she was acting as Kris Jenner at this point. She was being their manager and agent. Moving into the late 1920s, that's when they started appearing in short films. The Big Review, I think, is what the first one was called, or something like that. As we move on into the 30s, they changed their identity from the Gum Sisters to the Garland Sisters when they go to the World's Fair in Chicago. They went with their mom and they were at a theater they were going to be performing at with a comedian named George Jessel. George is the one that actually suggested Garland to them. So I'm like, thanks, dude. And also, you know, because Judy was getting older, maybe you guys should drop the baby name, like kind of like fit with her age now. So they did. And Judy wanted to have a different name to go by. She chose the name Judy because of a Hoagie Carmichael song. So she picked her first name. And she also has said the only time she felt wanted in her life was when she was performing. Now, the girls, they ended up booking a radio show. And this was like the first time that Judy was recognized like on her own. And she was 10 years old. She had a glowing rave review from Variety. And they loved her like so much. So they said when they were talking about their act or whatever and her singing her solo or whatever, he said, quote, "The 10-year-old sister of a pip of a lowdown voice, kids stopped the show," end quote. This is when Frank and Ethel were like, oh, shit, Judy might have it to be a star, you know, might actually have what it takes. So at that point, they kind of switched from the Garland Sisters to just focusing on Judy, which when I read her biography, I found out her sisters were kind of like, cool, don't care, because they didn't want to fucking do that. And they were happy for Judy because Judy wanted to do it. So they're like, yeah, go you.
That's good.
As her career starts, Judy talked about how she dreaded the end of the school day on Fridays. Obviously, like most kids her age, they'd be like, yeah, excited, weekend, whatever. But no, that meant Judy had to work. That meant every Saturday they would go to auditions and go do all of that. So at this point, they were living in Lancaster, so they had to drive down and it was like an hour drive and, you know, there and back and all of this stuff. Eventually, she started bringing her friend Muggsy along with her because she wanted to have Muggsy to keep her company because Ethel was stepping out too. Ethel was doing stuff with execs.
Oh.
Ethel, the mom. Yeah, she was fucking.
Oh,
she was fucking the dudes.
She was fucking.
Yeah, she was fucking the dudes to try to get her daughter a role. And like, listen to what, like, how this would transpire. Okay, so they do the audition. Then Ethel would take the girls like outside. There was this one instance in the book that they talked about where they went and sat like outside in the grass, like outside of the building or whatever. And Ethel would go into these offices and go into these like closed rooms and stuff with not even just like one dude. There was many times when it was multiple fucking dudes. And obviously like when they're kids, they didn't know what the fuck was going on. But like as adults, we all know what she was doing. We all know what she was doing. I'm not surprised. Like, she's a fucking piece of shit, but ugh, gross.
I mean, I'm not either.
Ethel decided to end up like kind of moving down by Hollywood and closer. So her and Frank, they weren't divorced or anything, but they just lived separate lives. Basically, he lived in Lancaster. She lived down there with the girls. It was just, it was all bad because Judy had a good relationship with her dad. Her dad was, you know, supportive and stuff with her and whatnot, and took her to the lot for like one of her first like big gigs type of thing before he died, because he dies. But Judy, they talk about like how it was just such a negative impact on the girls. Like they would cry and they like miss their dad so much. And then like when they would see him, they'd like run and jump in his lap and like all this stuff. And that just like hurt my heart so much because Ethel's awful. So that November, Judy had a big radio performance and it went off fantastic. So during this show, she debuted a song that a lot of people associate her with. It's called Zing Went the Strings of My Heart. And she just left it all like on the floor type of thing. Like, I don't know how else to describe that. Because at this time, Frank was doing really, really bad. He was extremely sick. He was actually in the hospital the night of this performance, but the staff still turned on the radio so he could hear it. But at this point, he was so badly off. They don't know if he like even actually registered, heard it, you know, that kind of thing. And like the girls knew their dad was super sick because he had spinal meningitis. That's what he died from. He was about to die, and then he did die, and it broke his girls' hearts. Not Ethel's, though. I'll tell you why a little later. After this, Judy gets a big ass contract. She's now 13 and she signs with MGM, which is a huge fucking deal. Her contract was signed on September 16th, and this was for 7 years. So they would have claim to Judy until she was 20, at least. Her starting pay was $100 a week. And when looking back on her time at MGM, in an interview, she's quoted saying, "The studio became a kind of surrogate parent. My mom would threaten me, 'Be good, or I'll tell Mr. Mayor.'" We'll talk about him in a second. He's like a producer type of shit. And Ethel continued to sleep with people, with execs and stuff, and eventually got on their payroll too somehow. Like, she weaseled her way to getting her own check as well as Judy's. This is the start of some horrific fucking shit. We are going to talk about some crazy dieting. They would do things to make her look younger as she got older, and like just all of these things. Okay, so I mentioned Mr. Mayer. So that is who was like the studio boss. I'm like, oh, Dan vibes. Louis B. Mayer. So it was said he, when this contract happened, he just decided to sign her on the spot. They didn't even get to the screen test part. They were just, he was just like, bet. But unfortunately, Judy, and I'm just like, what the fuck? Like, this doesn't make any fucking sense to me. So they marketed her as the ugly duckling. And I'm like, she was beautiful. Like, what the fuck? But her, all of her on-screen storylines and characters, she'd always be this like girl next door with some kind of like unrequited love or crush on, you know, whoever. She worked a lot in her early career with Mickey Rooney because he was also a teen actor at the time. People, when describing her, they said she didn't look like the rest of the MGM stars. She became this kind of avatar for the rejected, not sexy enough, not pretty enough person. Like, how fucked up is that? How fucked up is that? And she's 13. And she's fucking 13. This is such a pivotal time.
Right. She looked like a person. How dare she? But also, she was beautiful. It's true.
Her breakout role was like one of her first feature film roles. It was Pigskin Parade. Nobody expected it to like get as much attention and like positivity as it did, but that was a great thing in Judy's case. And after this, she also starred in Love Finds Andy Hardy in 1938, and she was with Mickey Rooney again. They were super popular as a pairing during this time, and they were in a ton of movies together. So apparently Judy was a big fan of this guy named Clark Gable.
Sorry.
I don't know who this guy is. I'm sorry. No, I'm dumb.
Like, I'm sorry. Only because like I was raised by my grandparents. So like, obviously I know like older.
Yeah.
But like, he was like the fucking heartthrob. There's literally a song that's dedicated to people who loved him.
Oh, I was about to say that.
Oh, sorry. My bad.
No, you're good. So he's Mr. It guy, but he's a fucking creep. That's why I'm like, I don't care to learn about you. Okay, so on his birthday, on February 1st, 1937, Judy performed the song you're talking about, Dear Mr. Gable, You Made Me Love You, at his birthday party. And I'm just also like, man, that made me think of Drew Barrymore too, because I'm like, a kid at an adult party. Okay. The performance went over amazingly. MGM decided to put this song in Broadway Melody, which came out in 1938. But gross. He was a creep. He was a fucking creep. He tried to make a move on her and he tried to fucking kiss her and she freaked out and she started crying and she went and like jumped in, you know, Louis, Mr. Mayor, whatever we want to call him, Mr. Mayor's lap, like fucking horrified, crying. And everyone's just laughing like, oh, so cute, like so silly, like whatever, like disgusting.
Clark Gable was the male lead in Gone with the Wind.
Oh, okay. Well, I haven't watched that movie since I was like 5 years old. And to be fair, I was more focused on Judy. Okay, I'm sorry.
No, I just think it's funny because you're like, I don't know who that is. And I was like,
Tara, yeah, you do. Yeah, you do. See, I'm a face person, not a name person. So it's fine. But anyways, fucking creep. Yeah, he's a fucking creep. He's a fucking creep.
That is creepy.
Mr. Mayor. I just like calling him Mr. Mayor.
I think it's fun.
Mr. Mayor is a creep as well.
I mean, I wonder how many times he fucked her mom.
Well, not only that. He was mean. He was mean and gross and disgusting. He would call Judy his little hunchback. I'm like, that's not a nice name.
That's so rude.
And then...
can you imagine if you had a hump? Like a hunch? Now I'm like, posture, Jessica.
Fix it. But,
fix it. But like, could you imagine being 13 and be like, oh, my little hunchback? I'd be like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Not only that, but like when they would have talks about like her singing and stuff, he'd be like, oh, I can really tell that came from your heart. And he would grab her fucking boob. He'd be like, oh, your heart.
So that's not where your heart is.
No.
That's not your heart.
But yeah, he would do that. Eventually, she called him out on it. She's like, no, fuck you. Don't fucking touch me. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you type of shit? And then he tried to gaslight her and be like, I don't know what you're talking about. I wasn't doing anything bad. I was just, you know, because what we were talking about. I'm a father figure to you. What do you mean?
We all know that all dads are great.
God. And not only that, but the media was also so mean to Judy. They referred to her as plump little Judy.
What is wrong with people?
Everything.
God, we're such a terrible, like humans, terrible.
So before we wrap up, the next thing that, this is the last topic we're going to talk about for Judy today. There's a little movie she booked 3 years later when she was 16. A little movie, you may have heard about it, maybe. She booked The Wizard of Oz at 16. This is when things went from bad to worse. At an early age, I didn't mention this earlier and I should have, but I'm mentioning it now. At like 9 or 10, Ethel started feeding Judy pills and she fed the other girls them too. And that's probably honestly why they were like, no, fuck this. I want to get away from this. They were called their pep pills or their peppy pills. It was basically she was getting uppers and then we're going to talk about more. This is also when they started increasing the drugs that they were giving her and stuff. And I don't remember if it was during this one or a different one I'm going to talk about later. They also started eventually giving her downers so she could sleep.
I think it was this one because they would give her so much.
Yeah.
They like chemically had to bring her down.
Yeah. I don't know if it was Mickey. They also did. They did it to a co-star too.
Mickey Rooney. Yeah.
Yeah. So she booked it and they just controlled every single thing about her because they needed her to be this picture perfect teenage girl star thing. And she's already got this like quote reputation of not being the cutest and all this other bullshit. They would call her a fat monster to her face. Judy was not fat. Judy was not fat. I'm sorry. She was not. Anytime she went to go eat, they would only give her chicken broth or what sounded like matzo ball soup, which I'm like, that has a lot of carbs in the matzo balls, but okay.
Maybe they're like tiny matzo balls.
Yeah. Or sometimes she was allowed some cottage cheese. But anything else? Nope. Fuck no. And they kept her on lock with that. They wouldn't let her sit with the other kid, like the other teens and stuff, because they didn't want anyone fucking like sneaking her actual food. And if they did, they fucking like took Judy out of there and shit. And it was just like, it was so much. And they were also giving her like eventually, pretty sure it started in this movie too, she was having like coffee pumped in her all day and had up to 80 cigarettes a day.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause they're appetite suppressants. Both of those are appetite suppressants.
On top of meds and meds and as the decades go, more fucking meds. Jesus. I found an article because y'all probably know The Wizard of Oz is like traumatic as fuck. So we're going to talk about some stuff. And some of this I did hear in... So the book is Get Happy. It's almost 600 pages, but it was so good. I listened to it on Audible. Recommend if you are interested. They go into so many details. Like we'd have like 10 parts if I went into all those details. Okay. So here's some horrific things that happen on set. The snow that's in the movie was made from asbestos.
I knew that, yeah. But I don't think they knew asbestos was like dangerous back then, I want to point out. Like,
right, because obviously they don't have the technology that we do now. But yeah, it was just chrysotile asbestos, also known as carcinogens, cancer-causing substances. So there was that. But like you said, I don't think they knew that was that. So during the time of filming, multiple people got caught on fire. And I was like, oh my fucking God. So the lady, Margaret Hamilton, who played the Wicked Witch, when she disappears and the smoke comes up, she fucking caught on fire. And it was so bad because like what was supposed to happen was there was a trap door that was supposed to like, you know, so she could go down before like the fire came, but it didn't fucking go like open. So she caught on fire and she had so many severe burns on her face, her hands, her eyelashes and her eyebrows were gone off her right eye, and her skin completely burned off her hand. They didn't send her home. Her friend had to come and get her.
That tracks.
They called her the next day asking when she was coming back to work.
She's like, when my hand heals.
Yeah, it took her 6 weeks to recover. And even when she came back, she had to wear green gloves because the nerves in her hands were still exposed because of the burning. She wasn't obviously 100%. And then her fucking stunt double, whose name was Betty Danko, she caught on fire too. She caught on fire during the broomstick scene. The pipe that had the smoke exploded and she had like permanent scarring and shit because of how bad she got burned. Like, what the fuck? Now, this one's pretty well known. So the original Tin Man was poisoned by his makeup. So to get that silver metallic-y look, the original Tin Man, Buddy Ebsen, he was painted with pure aluminum. And fun fact, frequent lung ingestion of aluminum is what sent him to the hospital after waking up one night with severe cramping in his hands, arms, and legs and was having difficulty breathing.
Because it's poisonous.
He had only been filming for 9 days.
Yeah, no, it's super poisonous.
Yeah. And so he was hospitalized. He was on oxygen and all of this stuff for 2 weeks. And again, the studio's just kind of like, when you coming back to work, bro? When you coming back to work? Like, because, you know, they're fucking assholes. Obviously, this is going to be a long recovery. So he couldn't come back. I'm hoping his doctor was like, no, fuck no, dude, you're not going. Like, right. Hopefully. But they did replace him with actor Jack Haley. They did use different makeup this time. I'm like, at least you learned your lesson. I guess the fire, like fucking 4 fires weren't enough. But they used some kind of like paint they probably shouldn't have. And that dude got an eye infection from the paint. I'm like, damn, what the fuck? Like, are you kidding me?
Probably could have also gotten lead poisoning.
Oh, probably that too, honestly. I keep saying fun fact. And if you're new, you're like, bitch, why are you so morbid? When I say fun fact, that there's no fun fact coming. It's the worst fucking thing ever.
I know.
Judy one day was slapped by the director, Victor Fleming, because she had supposedly a case of the giggles and could not get her shit together. So the dude fucking slapped her to snap her out of it. Like, take a fucking break till she chills out. It's not that fucking hard.
Yeah, let's not assault people for the sake of our movie.
And also, she was the second lowest salary out of the cast, and Toto was the only one paid less than her.
I knew that.
And she's the fucking star of the movie. But she did receive an Oscar for The Wizard of Oz on February 29th, 1940, when she was 17. So that's a cool fact, actually. That's actually a fun fact. That's actually a fun fact.
Fun fact.
But that is where we're going to stop for today. I hope you guys are enjoying this so far. In episode 2, we're going to talk about more of the fucked up stuff that they did to her the rest of her career. She has a handful of marriages and, you know, has her kids.
Literally a handful. I get it.
Literally a hand. No hate. After learning about her and that, I have some thoughts on that. But that will be for next time. So I'm going to put a pin in it because I've talked long enough for today. So with that, we'll go ahead and sign off and we will see you next Monday. Bye, guys.
Toodles.